Hello and welcome to a new year of RN First Bite. Michael McKenzie back with you, and today I'm here to spice up your life.
I'm just mad about saffron. Saffron's mad about me.
Yes, it's saffron. And its fragrance, its colour and its taste have infiltrated cuisines and cultures the world over.
They call me mellow yellow. They call me mellow yellow.
Quite rightly.
They call me mellow yellow.
Its mystique only added to by the enormous prices it commands. Those three crimson stigmas in each flower of the Crocus sativus have appeared on frescoes, they've turned up in the tombs of pharaohs and caused the downfall of saffron adulterers who were executed by outraged rulers for daring to pass off other spices as the real deal. So extraordinary are the now proven qualities of this spice that one senior neuroscientist recommends it for older people whose eyesight is failing.
What it does for the patient is it restores some of the lost vision and then stabilizes the retina against further degeneration for well over a year. And that's a dramatic outcome.
Jonathan Stone is Professor of Neurobiology at Sydney University. And after seeing the impacts of saffron in an Italian trial, Professor Stone's conducting his own research into reversing age-related macular degeneration using this same spice.
It's a degeneration of the retina, and it's one of the most common forms of adult blindness. It starts to hit you when you're old, and it affects the small patch of retina which you use for everything. Well, not everything, not for night vision, but you use it to read, you use it to recognize people's faces, to know who you're talking to in your family, to watch your grandchildren grow. And it's a slow loss of that central vision. It becomes misty and then it'll black out entirely.
And in this Italian trial, which was a small trial but high-quality trial, it was placebo, double-blind.
Placebo means that some of the patients were on the saffron and some were on pills that looked exactly the same but didn't contain the saffron. And double-blind means that the patient didn't know and also the people running the trial didn't know. One person obviously had the key to it all, but nobody knew during the trial who was taking what.
So what happened when this trial was conducted?
So it was a small trial, 25 patients. It had one other element, crossover, that some began on the pill, some on the placebo, and at 3 months they crossed over, and then the trial went another 3 months. But once you sorted out who was on what when, 23 of the 25 patients experienced measurable recovery in the electrical activity of the macular region of the retina and in their ability to read a Snellen chart. The effect seems to come on, and we've measured it in animals, in 1 to 2 weeks, and then will fade. If you stop taking the saffron, it will slowly fade and the disease will reappear.
And didn't, in fact, some of the participants in the Italian trial report just that very behaviour?
Yes, they did. So there's what we call the objective evidence, and then there's the anecdotes that go with it. And my understanding and discussing it with Benedetto Falsini, who led the trial, a very gifted clinician, he said, look, the patients would come to me and they'd say, oh, my vision cleared up, but now it's getting misty again. Which pill am I on? And he had to say, I don't know, and you don't know, and we won't know till the end of the trial, he said, but they were never wrong. They were never wrong. They could sense when their vision was fading.
And what's so exciting about this, Jonathan, is that the efficacy of saffron in the trial continues on apace. It doesn't lose its potency to do good over time.
No, it seems that if you stay on quite a low dose, that trial used 20 milligrams a day. If you stay on that well over a year, the retinas of these people were stable, there's a good chance that that's the reality that we're dealing with.
We'll come back to the neurological benefits of saffron shortly. But just in case you were wondering where Professor Jonathan Stone sources his saffron, well, it comes from a couple of places. One is Italy, but the other is a small supplier on a property in Tasmania.
We're stripping the stigma, the saffron, from the flower. And so we sit round a table. That happens on all the farms across Australia and New Zealand. I'm Nikki Noonan, and they call me the Saffron Queen from Tasmanian Saffron in Tasmania.
For the last 23 years, Nikki and her husband Terry have been sitting around that table taking three saffron stigmas from inside every saffron flower. The Noonans were the first to successfully grow the spice commercially in this country, and their first harvest was a mere post pack of stigmas. Now they grow high-quality Category 1 saffron in a network of 70 farms in southern Australia and New Zealand.
We've learnt a lot over 23 years. We literally started with a wheelbarrow, a spade and $1,000. And we produce 10 kilos in our network of extra Category 1 saffron, 10 kilos from 70 farms.
As Nikki takes us into the saffron laboratory. This is a laboratory. This is where you put your strand.
We've hand-picked the flower. We've extracted the saffron, we've dried it, stored it into big jars.
Never seen so much saffron in my life.
Yeah, this is the end of the harvest. Okay. And then from there, we pack into little tiny glass vials of 100 milligrams.
And how you and I can use 100 milligrams of saffron in the kitchen, Nikki will reveal soon. In the meantime, Professor Jonathan Stone continues to be fascinated with saffron's ability to stimulate our cells into what he calls neuroprotection.
There's something in saffron, and we have yet to identify it, and we're working on that too, which affects all cells of the body, gets into their genome, and induces them to upregulate their protective mechanisms.
No side effects?
Not at that dose, no. You get intestinal bleeding if you swallow 5 grams of it, I think it is in the literature, but that's a few thousand times what we need to get the neuroprotective dose. So there's no effective toxicity at the doses we use.
Now, the potential for saffron in not just this area of vision restoration can also be applied to what's only come to animal trial at the moment, as I understand it. That's to do with other areas of neuroprotection, which is Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease as well.
Yeah, well, there are quite a few degenerative diseases of the central nervous system, but AMD is one of the most common in the retina, and Parkinson's and Alzheimer's are the most common in the brain. And yes, we're trialing them in animal models first. That's the way we have to do it. And we're getting very encouraging results in terms of the preservation of the dopaminergic cells of the midbrain, which are the key pathology site in Parkinson's. And we're getting earlier results, but encouraging results with models of Alzheimer's disease. Models of Alzheimer's disease, much harder to interpret because that's the state of the field. But it appears that the effect of saffron and the other neuroprotectants we're trialing are not specific to retina or particular diseases. They're working on mechanisms of self-protection and self-repair, which are intrinsic probably to all neurons.
Now, you've spent 50 years in experimental research. Why is it that now you've decided to market saffron yourself in a tablet form before all trials have been completed? Doesn't that run against some of the very parameters of science that you've adhered to for so long?
So there's always a question at what level of knowledge should something come onto the market. And it's often decided by the big pharmaceutical companies and by the big regulatory agencies like the FDA, the Federal Drug Administration Authority in the United States, major players in major markets. But when we're dealing with what's effectively a nutraceutical, using something that's of low toxicity that's been ingested for years as a spice, and then another 5 years, 10 years to make people wait while massive trials are put through, I think is just not fair to those people who now suffering the diseases. And so I decided to give them the chance to try it for themselves and see if it helps them.
Couldn't I just go down to my local supermarket, pick up some saffron off a shelf and daily eat it?
Yes, you could.
And would that have benefits?
the only variables out there is that the post-harvest handling, it does vary immensely, and we don't know how much that affects efficacy. But yes, the saffron is, there's nothing special that we do to it except produce it in a form which is stable and easy for a patient to comply with.
They call me mellow yellow.
And why is saffron so expensive? Well, let's go through the maths. Every crocus corm or bulb is hand-planted, then it's nurtured to harvest, then three stigmas are hand-picked from inside each flower on top of the bulb. It then takes stigmas from 20 flowers to make just 100 milligrams of saffron, which is why those little glass jars retail for about $15 a pop. However, Nikki Noonan is at pains to point out that of the four classes of saffron produced around the globe, their network of growers is up there with the best.
It's a really rich, deep red, and if we put boiling water into that, in about an hour we would have some colour through, but in 24 hours it would be a brilliant orange red. So we tell people how to do it. So you can mortar and pestle it and use it straight away. But to get all the properties out, the saffron, all the aroma, the picrocosines for taste, and the crocine, the colour, 24 hours is ideal. So we put that on the back of our pack so that people know how to use it.
You know, it's used in baking and curries and all manner of cuisines.
Liqueurs, chocolates, bouillabaisse, scones. There's a photo on the wall over there of my husband's saffron scones, you know.
He makes a mean saffron scone.
He makes a mean saffron scone. And one of my favourite recipes is, and everybody's got into it now, but it's saffron poached pears with a saffron syrup. And that's just magnificent. It's infused overnight, the syrup with the saffron, and the pears are infused, and that's just beautiful. And with a saffron ice cream, that's really, really nice too. I'm just mad about saffron.
I think it's mad about you.
I think it is.
Tasmanian saffron grower Nikki Noonan and her husband Terry's recipes for saffron scones and pears, also poached in saffron, are up on the RN First Bite website right now. As for the exciting evidence of saffron's ability to stimulate neurons to self-repair and restore, we have links to the latest research plus an extended interview with neurobiologist Professor Jonathan Stone up online as well. All you have to do is type RN First Bite into your search engine and you should find us in a flash. As this story covers the flavours and the science of saffron, we'd love to hear any of your experiences with the spice. There's a comment section online as well, right below the story. Still to come on RN First Bite, our first one for 2013, blinding us with science. It's a new standard on what food companies can claim or not claim about their product's health on the label. It's come into law, but enforcement? Well, that's another thing. So while we wait for that to occur, let's discuss our own self-discipline. Here's food writer and author, Kate McGee.
In the film Bernie, Jack Black tells Shirley MacLaine that her incessant chewing drives him nuts. He tells her he can understand 25 chews for each mouthful of a steak, but not for refried beans, adding that it's all unnecessary work for her jaw muscles. Think about them, he implores. Back in the days before cooking, our jaw muscles really earned their keep. We most likely spent half the day chewing tough, raw food, as most of our primate relatives still do. Thanks to fire, food was cooked, it became softer, and we could eat it faster. So then we chewed less, ate more, and piled on kilos. Chewing came back into fashion with Horace Fletcher, the influential health faddist of the late 19th and early 20th century. This American, the great masticator, advocated that we should chew 32 times before swallowing. It became known as Fletcherizing, and he proclaimed that he would turn a pitiful glutton into an intelligent Epicurean. Nature shall castigate those who don't masticate, was one of his catchphrases. From 1895 to 1919, he taught that prolonged chewing led to better systemic and dental health, and precluded overeating, which consequently saved money. People were also cautioned not to eat except when they were good and hungry, and to avoid dining when they were angry or worried. There are other benefits to chewing. Continuous jaw movement apparently improves memory, helps increase alertness and concentration. Research has shown that the rhythmic motion of chewing has a stress-reducing effect because of the relaxed and satisfied feelings it generates. Swedish archaeologists have found wads of chewed birch resin, which dental experts conclude were chewed by a caveman teenager over 9,000 years ago. The way other people chew can be maddening, as Jack Black found out. There are turbo chewers, whose mouth looks like a bobbin. Then there's the gangster chew with intermittent movement. And the I gotta have more air chew. Eating food should be pleasurable. Chewing helps release flavour and to increase saliva flow, which means more frequent swallowing and easier digestion. 32 chews may not be for you, but try what's called mindful eating. Buddhist students are given three sultanas, or a mandarin, to spend 10 or 20 minutes gazing at, musing on, holding and patiently masticating. Mindful eating is anti-diet. It's not about giving up anything at all. It's about experiencing food more intensely, especially the pleasure of it. Maybe it's the cure for obesity.
Food writer and top masticator Kate McGee, and her history of 32 chews brings back memories of my mother enforcing it rigidly at the dinner table. These days I've dropped down to 10 chews maximum, which I think does coincide with the expansion of my waistline, so perhaps chewing is a virtue. You're with RN First Bite on air and online. My name's Michael McKenzie, and if you want to catch up with past programs or you want to make sure you don't miss any of the new ones, you can always subscribe to our weekly podcast. We've got a link on the story side of our homepage, or you can search for RN First Bite in iTunes. It's really very easy. Also, your comments are very important to us, even the ones that can us. Please just tell us what you think. We can take it. Maybe you could chew us out 32 times.
I don't want pork chops and bacon. That won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim frim sauce with the os and fay with shafafa on the side.
The Australian food industry knows that despite our rising levels of obesity, we all worry still about what we eat. So in selling us a product, they do fall over themselves to make any claims they can about its health or nutritional worth. But have those claims of being calcium-rich, for example, or high in antioxidants, actually been borne out by proper scientific substantiation? Well, in mid-January 2013, a new food standard became law designed to protect you and I from bogus claims of health and nutrition benefits. And with me is the Federal Parliamentary Secretary for Health and Ageing, Catherine King. Catherine King, welcome to RN First Bite. First up, have we been lied to up until now?
Well, look, I think you've got to go back in history a bit to look at when regulators first allowed health claims. And I think the idea, you know, they weren't allowed very much at all. And then as food technology and food production started to get more and more sophisticated, we did start to learn a bit more that, you know, calcium is actually good for us. And we know that we want to be able to highlight those things. So health claims were allowed to try and encourage, to some extent, food producers to really start making healthier foods. And then the quid pro quo of that was that they could make health claims.
Were they being policed in so doing?
Yeah, look, they were, but there was quite a broad breadth of what they were allowed to do. And the standard allowed, you know, literally what we see on our supermarket shelves now. In my view, what's happened, and I think obviously in the view of all of the food regulatory ministers across the country, it's that then got to the point where you've started to see the borderline between what's a health claim and in what in essence is a marketing claim really, really blurred. So that's why we've brought into law a new health and nutrition claim standard, and it's taken a long time to actually get to this point. It really has. These things are often very contentious. There are very contested views in this space as well.
Under the new standard, what kind of adherence do food manufacturers have to now make?
Well, manufacturers can start using the new food standard now, but they also can continue to use the old standard. There's a 3-year transition period where by that 3-year period, they must use the new standard.
A 3-year transition period for the industry just means another 3 years of confusion for the consumer.
I think what it does do is actually recognises the reality of food production for a start, and I think it is simple just to say, I've just changed the label. It doesn't quite work like that. Mm-hmm. But I think it also means that what you're trying to do is really encourage good innovation, and what I want to see is reformulation of products. Reformulation of products where if people want to make a health claim, they have to start now saying, well, how are we going to get that level of salt out of our product? What does that mean? Salt's a preservative that adds to the taking that out means the shelf life of a product can deteriorate pretty quickly. What does that mean for both their manufacturing and their stock and distribution chains? All of that work, that's what companies actually are starting to do now. So that's what we're actually trying to drive is to some extent, a reformulation of these products, particularly so that consumers they're continuing to buy the same brand of bread, but it's going to have less salt in it.
Let's talk about the standard itself, the new one that came in on January the 18th. If I'm a food manufacturer and I say my product is high in calcium, under the new standard, what do I have to meet as a benchmark to make that claim?
Yeah. Okay. The first thing to understand is there's different levels of health claims. So there are claims that are just content claims. So this product contains calcium, for example. So in essence, it either does or it doesn't contain calcium. So that to some extent is a content claim. So you can make a claim that it contains calcium. It has to contain a certain amount of calcium before you can make that claim. If you're wanting to make what's more of a general level or a high level health claim, which is this product contains calcium and that's good for your bones, or even further, this product contains calcium and that prevents preventing osteoporosis. That's a very high level claim. In order to make those claims, the product has to meet a nutritional profiling scoring criteria. In other words, you'd look at the nutritional information panel, and Fazan's has got a complex formula it's developed.
The Food Standards Australia New Zealand.
Yes, that's right. And it basically says how much sugar, how much fat, how much salt, and then you look at the positive nutrients, so how much fibre has it got in it, and that's balanced out. So if it's too high in sugar, it in essence won't be able to make the claim at all.
Okay. Who substantiates that the food manufacturer is following the new standard?
So enforcement of all food standards is done by state and territory food authorities, and then that's often passed down within states and territories, so you might have a local environmental health officer as well. So each of the states and territories, enforcement rests with them.
And as of January the 18th, if I am this company, I've just been reading some of the notes on the Fazan's website saying that here's the process you have to do. You have to sort of get a piece of letterhead and have it signed off by the chief executive officer saying, I substantiate that my food meets this so-called scientific criteria under either a general or a high-level health and nutrition claim.
That's correct, yep. So the director of the company is required to say, yep, what we are saying is correct.
Does it worry you that it's still self-substantiation at the outset?
Certainly I think most food processors in Australia who employ lots of people in this country, I've got a number in my own electorate as well, do want to do absolutely the right thing and do want to comply with standards. And I think having a director actually have to sign off and say, what we are claiming this food has meets this criteria, this standard absolutely, is a pretty powerful tool.
In the meantime, for the next 3 years, as consumers, we sit on our hands and hope that some companies are telling us the truth and the others are letting things slip. Well, we just don't know, do we?
Well, I think that we've had a really powerful signal sent to the food industry, and there's also a lot happening in some other parts of the portfolio that I work in as well, that's sending a very clear signal to the food industry that we are highly concerned about claims that are being made on food. We want the food industry to innovate. We want the food industry to sell healthy food. So I think there's not only obviously in the changes to the health and nutrition claim, there's a lot of work being done through the food and health dialogue on voluntary reformulation of products. There's also some work being done on front of pack labelling as well, which is again seeing industry and public health experts actually come together and start to develop a system that will, you know, hopefully come into place much more quickly than this standard. So there's some work happening in some other spaces as well. So I think that governments right the way across the country have sent a pretty clear signal to the food industry that enough's enough. I think we are tired of seeing some of the, you know, claims, and I've been subject to it too. I'm a parent of a small child, so I think we're highly susceptible to wanting to buy, you know, really healthy food for our children, and can be highly susceptible to some of those claims as well. So I think that consumers are much more aware of it, but also there's a pretty clear signal with the change in the law, but also some other work that's happening in some other spaces.
Catherine Keane, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Good to talk to you, and thanks for your interest.
Federal Parliamentary Secretary for Health and Ageing, Catherine King. And for more details on those new labelling standards that came into law last month, we'll have some links on our website to Food Standards Australia New Zealand. And you can find out more about what defines the difference between general and high-level health claims. It also explains how you can make an application, if you're a food company, for you to be benchmarked under the standard. And by the way, if your company does start to adhere to these new standards in under 3 years, would you mind telling us so we know we can believe your labelling? We'd appreciate that. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter by typing at @RNFirstBite, and you can also be part of the conversation on our Facebook page as well. Next week, back of the house. A clinical psychologist writes about the secret life inside restaurants, and I risk life and limb to harvest honey off a suburban roof. I have to say, the bees and me are no longer on speaking terms. RN First Bite, produced by Maria Tickle, Melissa May on technicals. My name's Michael McKenzie, and I'll catch you next week.
I want my mind fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the aus and fay with Chef Baba on the side.
The exciting new world of smartphones and tablets makes life so simple. You can call or text, email, Facebook, Twitter, poke, like, follow, browse, swipe, Skype, update, investigate your RSS feed via HTTP and much, much more. Or you can just download the ABC Radio mobile app and listen to your favourite shows on the go. Download it now from abc.net.au/radio.